A portion of this broadcast is brought to you by KVRF members and the generosity of Silva Insurance Services, located in the heart of Palmer, Alaska. A locally owned, community-minded Palmer business since 2006, finding the right insurance for your home, your sled, your ATV, health insurance, business insurance, including employee benefits. Silva Insurance, a strong, committed community partner.
I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kevin. I'm here with Sam in the studio, and we're interviewing Dr. Kim Kraft, a doctor of physical therapy. She works at the Advanced Physical Therapy Center in Wasilla, and that's off the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. And we're really excited to have you here on the show, Kim. It's going to be a really full hour, no doubt about it. We want to hear about your holistic approach to physical therapy, and I know that you've got a lot to say about that.
Welcome, everyone. This is Sam, and I want to tell you a little bit about Kim. We've got most of this information posted on our Facebook page, but I'm going to give you a little intro to her, and then we're going to talk to Kim about how she got interested in physical therapy in the first place. So Kim graduated from Regis University in Colorado with a master's degree in physical therapy in 1998, and she earned a clinical doctorate with a specialty in manual physical therapy from the University of St. Augustine, Florida in 2006. Kim holds manual therapy certifications through the IAOM-US and through the University of St. Augustine. At Advanced Physical Therapy's Matsu Valley Clinic, she's a senior physical therapist and manages and directs the Women's Health Program. She specializes in myofascial release techniques and in the treatment of women's health issues. In addition, she's a certified kinesio-tapping practitioner. Kim's developed a comprehensive women's health program at Advanced Physical Therapy, allowing her to reach out to women in the Matsu Valley and effectively treat disorders such as pelvic pain, pelvic floor muscle dysfunction, painful intercourse, coccygeal pain, infertility problems, lymphedema, endometriosis, urinary incontinence, interstitial cystitis, menstrual problems, fibromyalgia, and painful scars due to breast reduction, hysterectomy, C-section, episiotomy, and post-mastectomy scarring. That's quite a mouthful. So you have quite a range of clientele, yeah?
I do.
So what we'd like to talk about is just how you got interested in becoming a physical therapist in the first place and what led you to where you are now.
I think when I started out many years ago, it was more exercise-based, thinking that's really what physical therapy was about. And my career path has taken me down the path of manual therapy, which is basically just hands-on therapy, many different kinds of approaches, different techniques, but basically it's hands-on therapy. But I think the interest overall initially was just to help people improve their quality of life. That was, you know, just thought I could intervene, help them through a healthier lifestyle, through exercise. And when I started the Women's Health Program, I started that when I got up here to Alaska 4 years ago, and that really took me down the path of myofascial release and very much a hands-on approach. Still teach exercise, as I think all physical therapists do to some degree. But the biggest change for me was to start looking more at a whole body instead of segmenting the body out, treating a knee, treating an ankle, treating a hip. So the full body approach probably has been the biggest shift, I think, in my care in the last 4 years.
Was there any particular instance in your life where you had an issue and you ended up going to a physical therapist at all? Had you had any experience before with physical therapy, or was it just something you decided to do after getting your undergrad degree?
I did. When I was 10, I fell off a horse and fractured my arm and that was my very first encounter with physical therapy. And years later, when, you know, I've been asked this question several times, you know, why did you want to be a physical therapist? And I think that probably played into it quite a bit. That was my first interaction. I had a good experience. Had I had a bad experience, I may not be a physical therapist today, but it was a good experience. And I think that was probably my early influence.
What was good about it?
They empowered me to treat myself. I didn't realize that when I was, you know, 10 years old. But looking back on that, they taught me the things I needed to do to treat my body and get me better. It wasn't this fix-it mentality. It was, here, you need to do this to get your arm better, which was a good thing because I left for the summer and I was on my own and I was getting my arm better. And it was a bad fracture and I had a contracture and was in a cast for several months and really had no mobility in my arm, so I was able to get all that back. And
how long did it take to get your full arm use back?
It took about 3 months, but the interesting thing is I thought that's what it took, but it took decades. Once I started doing myofascial release and once I really got into manual therapy, because that's joint work as well, not just soft tissue work, there were blocks and limits to motion, and there was an altered neuromuscular response where the timing of the muscle was off, the end feel of the joint was off. So even though I thought it had recovered completely, there were a lot of gaps in that recovery. And I think that's probably the norm with most people. We're a society that when we're not in pain anymore or we've restored motion, we just think, okay, that's, oh, ooh, I got over that treatment or I got over that injury fairly well. You know, I'm glad that's over with. But there's a lot of things that are still residual, and that was certainly the case with my arm.
That's a really interesting point, because I think a lot of people are walking around with, anybody who's been physically active, especially Alaskans, you know, mm-hmm. people who ski and snowboard mm-hmm. and mountain bike and ice climb and
work
all
up
sorts
on the slope.
You know, and all the bumps and bruises that we take. I mean, I consider physical therapy part of my preventative medicine healthcare regimen. You know, I go whether I'm currently in pain or not, just like I go, I get acupuncture, I would get massage or
right.
chiropractic work or Rolfing. I consider it just another piece of that puzzle to make sure functionally my body's working really well together. So, you know, all of these different pieces and parts are working together. And so that's interesting when you talk about having an injury that really didn't, you thought it was healed because functionally it wasn't limiting you, you thought.
Right.
But a lot of those things can cause problems down
it
the line if people
does.
Don't take care of them.
Yeah, we compensate, and then that becomes our normal way to move. And we're not aware that we've compensated. That just becomes our norm, and I think it sets you up for the next injury, the next injury.
Mm-hmm.
And that's most people's injury history, if you mm-hmm. look back on it.
Yeah, and I want to slow down just a little bit, because I use the word myofascial release, and I'm wondering if you can maybe explain a little bit about that. And then also, you mentioned timing, neuromuscular timing. And maybe if you can describe some of the mechanisms in action there and as it relates to function, like what's actually going on there, and then how your work actually resolves that.
Well, the myofascial work, when we train as physical therapists, typically that's not really a whole system that's addressed as a system. I mean, I certainly didn't learn it like that. It's, you know, the white tissue you'd cut through in a cadaver lab to get to the precious muscle
so,
beneath,
so we're saying,
you know.
So myofascial, we're saying the muscular tissue attached with the fascia,
we're
the
saying,
white stuff wrapped around
well,
it.
Well, it's yeah. everything. It's mm-hmm. the fascial covering is around every muscle fiber, every muscle sheath, every muscle, every cell, every organ, every artery, every vein. And that's what we didn't really have an appreciation for. You know, I wasn't educated early on that we had this whole system. It truly is a three-dimensional web that connects us from head to toe. So if you disrupt that system through injury, through surgeries, what looks like a nice little neat healed scar on the outside isn't such a nice little neat package on the inside. So that whole fascial system is disrupted, and it can affect anywhere in the body, head to toe. So, you know, you could have a scar on your abdomen, and that's leading into knee pain or foot pain or headaches down the road. So it really is a full-body, three-dimensional web that really affects everything, you know, so.
It's incredible. And so how do you actually diagnose, you know, that there's a, you know, the relationship between a knee and an abdominal scar, you know, is how would you actually locate the...
The first thing I do is look at somebody's posture, and that tells me a lot. Just the way that they stand, the way that their body's being pulled into certain directions, you know, a foot could be turned out. I look at scars. I look at those scars and inquire about those scars.
And so you were saying that the myofascial work is not part of the physical therapy training. So I'm going to back up a little bit further and just let's talk about what I know going through physical therapy school tends to be, it's pretty intense. I mean, it's a very hard program to get accepted into and then to get through. There's a lot of work involved. It's kind of like going to medical school in a lot of ways, right?
It is. It's very intense. And I think, you know, what med school is probably similar. You come out and, you know, you're taught not to hurt anybody. You know, you don't want to hurt anybody and you're safe to practice.
Right.
But really, whatever path you choose as your career path, it's pretty wide open. And then that's where you start to receive your specialty training.
So do you get the basic education like an MD would get, or do you work more like
we're the physicians of the musculoskeletal system. So when you look at the doctor of physical therapy, it's the physicians of the musculoskeletal system. You know, we're not treating medical issues, so to speak, but musculoskeletal, you know, shoulder injuries, whether it's joint tissue, you know, that's our specialty area. You don't. You won't come to us to treat diabetes or for a heart condition. You know, the exercise piece. You know, right. we would train that. You know, help with that and managing a disease process such as that. But it's not, you know, treating medical diagnoses. It's more functional diagnoses.
So there's lots of different. A lot of people have heard the term occupational therapy. So how would you differentiate physical therapy from occupational therapy? And then also we talked a little bit about what you do, manual physical therapy. You're doing hands-on work. And I think a lot of people assume they go to the physical therapist and the physical therapist gives them exercises to do. And they're looking at, you know, range of motion, improving range of motion and improving strength. But they're not necessarily, I think it's not necessarily associated with somebody actually putting their hands on them and doing work on their body. So we could talk a little bit about those things. So a little bit about what's the difference between manual physical therapy and, you know, exercise-based approach, and then also what's the difference between physical therapy and occupational therapy, those things.
Physical therapy and occupational therapy, there is a lot of overlap. Years ago, they used to say the physical therapist was gross motor movement and the occupational therapist was fine motor movement. And, you know, still, the occupational therapist tends to work more with the hands and fine motor. But it's really not that distinct. I mean, you can have occupational therapists that are working on the whole body, and I don't think there's anything within their professional guideline that limits them, especially, you know, working with children. You can have an OT and a PT side by side, and you might wonder who's the OT and the PT. There's that much overlap. But it tends to be more fine motor control versus more gross motor control, or did years ago.
Mm-hmm. I tend to think about it as life skills. You know, the occupational therapist is trying to get you back able to do the, like, driving or feeding yourself or walking from point A to point B, like stuff that you need to do for your life. And I think about the physical therapist more like the actual, more the recovery from the injury. You know, you broke your leg and you're trying to get the range of motion back and trying to develop the strength of the muscles back and trying to reconnect that whole system. But that's how it sits in my head.
So, yeah, you know. There's a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. There really is a lot of overlap. And depending on what the PT or the OT specializes in, you know, there's going to be a lot of overlap with it. But I can remember early on in my career, the OTs had a kitchen. You would go into the OT treatment room and there was a whole kitchen, and that's what you're saying, more, you know, getting back to your life skills, just to be able to feed yourself,
like,
after
a stroke. Yeah.
Exactly. So that could be an OT treatment, you know, just walking around in the kitchen and, you know, teaching somebody to basically how to care for themselves.
Balance
again.
And spatial awareness. And
but there's times where, you know, we'll go out to somebody's car and work with them getting in and out of a vehicle. If that's where they're having difficulty, or if it's taking care of their child, they might bring their child into the clinic just to watch how they're moving. That's a big part of it, you know, how people move outside of the clinic. They're only with me anywhere from 1 to 3 hours a week. So what they do outside of the clinic is extremely important, and what they're willing to change, what they're not willing to change. You know, if they're not willing to change, I'm only going to take them so far.
Right.
Because, you know, it's the things that we do day in and day out that we pay the most attention to. We're very much creatures of habit. So we're probably moving, a lot of us are moving the same way we did when we were 10 or 12 years old. We're doing things the exact same way.
So when you're working with somebody doing manual therapy, can you describe what it is you're doing? What is the technique? And is it actually, is it a pressure on a given trajectory in the body where you're trying to loosen up the fascia? And, you know, then would you determine certain exercises that they then can do to reinforce the work you've done? Or is the work that you've done sufficient to actually hold the change, the desired change, as long as, you know, they begin to move in a more deliberate way that's posturally appropriate?
There's different techniques, for sure. Some of the principles of the myofascial work that would differ maybe from what you think of as traditional massage, because that's soft tissue mobilization or manipulation. There's no lotions, so we're not sliding on the skin, and basically you're pressing down into what we would call the barrier. If you push harder than that, it feels like almost like you're trying to sink something underwater, like a raft underwater. Working too hard, trying to force a system that can't be forced. So you go to the barrier and then you wait. And you wait for this, you wait for the releases, basically. So that's pretty much the premise behind it. And then the more skilled you get, you feel those releases, and then you move with the release. But you're not forcing the tissue. That's the structural part of MFR. There's, you know, many different types of manual therapy. Joint work. Some therapists are mobilizing or manipulating joints, and to them, you know, that's their expertise with manual therapy. The joint and I was trained early on, the joint and the soft tissue go together. If a joint isn't moving well, then that tissue accommodates the restriction with that joint. Same thing with the tissue itself. If the tissue isn't moving well, that joint can't go through its full range of motion, so then the joint's going to be limited over time. So you really can't separate them out. I've never really been able to separate those two out, really, in my mind, my whole career. I just thought, no, one, whether you decide to mobilize the soft tissue first or the joint first, that's the individual call of the therapist, and maybe not even the same way every time. That's more of an individual decision you would make, you know, with that patient, with an individual patient.
And you do some stuff before you start, because you've worked on me before, and the what you call rebounding, and then you've also done the skin rolling technique. So if you can talk a little bit about those two things.
The skin rolling, which is similar to what you do with the gua sha.
Yeah.
Yes. So skin rolling can be an assessment and a treatment, and that's more of the structural part of MFR, myofascial release. So you're basically rolling the skin. It can be painful. It feels good where the tissue moves well. And where the tissue doesn't move well, a high percentage of the time, that is where the dysfunction is or the adhered tissue. And it's not very comfortable. People have different tolerances to it. They get an increased tolerance to it by the second or third time. And people that have said, don't ever do that on me again, have come back weeks later and said, I never thought I would ask you this, but would do skin roll me again. I have people that come in and they ask for it. But it really does. It gives you freedom to move. It's almost like taking off a straitjacket. And then kind of going back to your question, Kevin, when once that tissue is freed up and then it's able to move, often there's a spontaneous strength return. So then it's easier to get, you've now allowed these fibers to be available for recruitment from the neurological system, you know, how the word that just comes in and innervates the muscle. So now you've freed up the fibers that are available, and sometimes they do have just a spontaneous strength return. It's certainly easier than it was trying to strengthen a muscle that's bound down and adhered. If you look at scar tissue or just tissue that you know doesn't move well, you can strengthen and attempt to strengthen over and over again, but the fibers just aren't available to work optimally.
So let's pull that apart, because you're using the words adhere and adhesion, and I don't know that our listeners necessarily understand that, but they may have heard that term from their physical therapist or from their Rolf or even from their acupuncturist or their chiropractor. So I want to pull apart what is, when you're saying adhesion or adhered, what that looks like, and that talks a little bit to what's going on in that white tissue in the fascia, because you shared a video with us, Muscle Attitudes,
right,
that we watched, and we looked at the fascia and with a little mini camera that looks underneath the skin and looks into this white tissue that people just, you know, generally move aside to get to the muscle, and you can see that there are these little intertwined fibers that are full of fluid, and as the muscle contracts, you can see these fluid layers changing and moving, and it's very dynamic.
Absolutely.
And so what in that context would an adhesion look like?
I think of an adhesion, if you think of a wool blanket that maybe all the fibers are just flattened down on itself. So, you know, if you held your hands, you know, a fraction of an inch apart, it should slide and glide freely. And that crystalline structure that is fluid-filled, it's amazing that we can see that now with the technology. Because those releases, that's what we've been feeling for years under our hands. So that strolling under the skin and the muscle attitudes, that's a video that, you know, really is amazing that we can see. But we're 70% water, and we should be fluid. So an adhesion would be tissue that has dried out, and it doesn't move. It doesn't get out of the way, whether it's the fascia covering organs. You know, we are mobile beings and very fluid beings, and our tissue should move freely. And when it doesn't, those are the adhesions. I think of it, most people would probably understand it when they think of scar tissue. If you touch over a scar and you move it back and forth and you move it multidirectionally and it just doesn't move, it kind of sticks down, it tacks down. Mm-hmm. So it's dry, for one, it's fibrotic, it loses its lubrication and its fluid.
But these things can be deep in the body, too. It's not like we think, you know, the scar
Absolutely.
Tissue, we think of surface scar tissue, you know, like you actually have surgery and there's a scar, an accident, or you have, you know, tightness in a particular area that you can feel. But since the fascia covers all the organs, you can have adhesions.
Absolutely. In,
like organ to organ or things, you know.
Hysterectomies, right? Gallbladder removals, mm-hmm. you know, some of the common surgeries that we see. It's, you know, that's a lot of tissue removed, and you might see one little scope hole on the outside,
right.
But it's, you know, it creates chaos within the body underneath. And the interesting thing about the myofascial work, I don't know where it's going to pull into. So there's things that I look at and try to read the body, and it's actually called the fascial voice, and I might look at an area to get read. So say I was working, you know, on your abdomen, Sam, and your neck gets bright red. I know that I just pulled into that area of your body through what I think of like as a lever, like using the fascial system. And it could be different with Kevin. Kevin's knee might light up red, or he might start scratching, that people will itch commonly. So those are cues to me as I'm treating that I've pulled into that area, and when I inquire verbally, there's usually some old injury, some old resolved injury. Where someone, that's my old dog bite. I was attached by a dog. Or, oh, yeah, that's that old knee surgery I never told you about. Or, you know, the, oh, by the way, injuries. I rolled the vehicle off of a mountain in Colorado. You know, people don't come in and disclose all of these things, but it's all of these old injuries with that same body. So a lot of that comes up when we do the myofascial work, which is intriguing to me, and it's one of, you know, it's one of my favorite ways to treat these days. I love that because you're listening to the body, and it's a fast, efficient way to treat out a lot of old injuries, that, you know, to really truly treat the whole body. It's the first time I think in my career that I can say I'm truly treating the whole body. And it's, you know, it's mind, body, spirit. Where those old injuries, when all that old trauma is, there's usually emotions linked to that. And as the tissue releases, there's quite often an emotional release. Maybe not right there in the clinic, but later on, you know, that night, next day, everybody responds differently to it. Some people go home and cry. Some people are happy. Some people, fortunately, they don't all go home and cry, or they probably wouldn't come back and see me. But they might, their sleep, some of them sleep well. Some of them that haven't slept in years will say, wow, I got the first good night of sleep in years. Some are all amped up and they can't sleep. So it creates a little chaos in the body, and I think the chaos is good when we look at it, you know, in that form of chaos, that something's happening. And that's what we want. Something needs to change and be jump-started, and that change is healing. They start to heal. It can't just stay the same. If it was just going to stay the same, then, you know, they don't need to come see me.
So movement's right. Good.
Yeah, it seems like fluidity really is the hallmark of healing, and the life impulse itself. And from a holistic perspective, it seems like setting the stage or the context for treatment is to really prepare the patient for change. And
absolutely.
That might be on many levels. It might be the readiness to look into dietary changes or lifestyle changes, or maybe actually looking into some traumatic experiences with maybe a little more space and a willingness to open it up if it really needs to be.
Absolutely. And if you know that, I think that's some of our plateaus and blocks to healing. You know, I'm not going to fix anybody. I'm a facilitator. I never say, "Oh, I'm a healer. Come to me and I'll heal you." You know, I'm a facilitator, and if people are willing to do the hard work, they can get to different levels, and I can help take them to those different levels. Some people will plateau. If they're not willing to go into, like, whether it's deep physical pain or deep emotional pain, then they're just not ready, and I can disconnect from that outcome. I certainly don't take it personal. They'll go away. Sometimes they come back 6 months later. Hey, I wasn't quite ready, or, oh, man, I've just kicked off, just... You know, they're not calling it chaos, but they just needed to go away and process some things and then come back. And like you said, Sam, it's part of your, almost like a regime, a healthy regime. I feel the same way about it, and I feel the same way with acupuncture. It's, you know, do the things that are healthy for your body, and you go down your path of healing. And then wherever you need help along the way, get some help. You know, people come in, we call them tune-ups. I might not see them for a year
right.
or 6 months, or, you know, certainly if they get injured again, if it's beyond what they can self-manage, they come back and see me.
One thing that from our experience is that the body, the human being, it's hard to say that there's limits, you know, because there's people that have come in with an array of symptoms and a history of, you know, a lot of accidents, and they're suffering from a lot of injuries, and just... I'm like overwhelmed. I'm like, wow, I don't know what's possible here. But if that attitude and that sort of that interest, that engagement, that fire for change is there, I've found that it's like, whoa, all bets are off. Let's see where this goes. And I'm wondering if maybe you have some stories that you might like to share. There's one actually on that.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
go ahead. What I didn't realize is, like, the power with the myofascial work, where you can make deep, deep changes, and you can affect people's medical symptoms. And it's, you know, things like hypoglycemia, things like, you know, bowel problems, intestinal problems. You know, you can start to release that tissue in the abdomen, and it changes the system. And that's not something I had really experienced with manual therapy. You know, mobilizing a joint, and then, you know, I've done that my whole career, that needs movement as well. Movement is lubrication to the body. But you can take a patient, in the myofascial world, there's a saying, find the pain, look elsewhere for the cause. And very rarely are people in there for, you know, what they think they're coming in for. You know, it's something else, and that's okay. You know, they think they're coming in for knee
right.
pain or shoulder pain or whatever, and that's good. That's always where we start with that, you know. But things like rashes popping up on the body, I mean, I've seen kind of some pretty interesting things the last couple years. Bruises where somebody was maybe beat. I saw that on a back where doing the myofascial work, just this bruise just popped up. And then the lady, she wasn't in there before that. That was 20 years ago.
Wow.
It's that tissue memory. So those are the very, and I don't fully understand tissue memory. You know, every day, every year, I think I'm understanding a little bit more of it. I'm not sure we understand it. I think we understand so little about healing. We were all in Dr. Ellenberg's lecture. On cancer and alternative treatments. And what did he say? 2% maybe, the think tank, you know, the big brains in science went away, and they said, what do you really understand? What do we know?
Right.
And it's such a small percentage. So I certainly wasn't trained in that regard, that, you know, tissue memory, that I could see bruises on people or, you know, old sunburns resurface, what looks like chemical burns on the body. people can go into a pretty big healing crisis with some of this work. But again, you know, I try to help them through it the best I can. And if they're willing to keep going, I'm willing to keep trying to take them further and further.
That's fantastic. We've got to take a break here in a few moments, and we'll come back with Dr. Kim Kraft, and we'll talk about her women's health program. Thanks for joining us tonight, and we'll see you in just a few minutes.
Community radio is what you make it. If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us on the web, radiofreepalmer.org. We're looking for ideas, we're looking for volunteers, and we're looking for help. Thank you so much, and enjoy.
To Bridge to Everywhere, and I'm Sam, and we were having a conversation with Kim Kraft, physical therapist, and I wanted to pick back up on a few things that you were saying. There's a lot that came out in the first half hour. So one thing going along the lines of what we were talking about with healing, on our website, one of our favorite teachers made a comment about healing, and she said, people come in with knee pain and they end up getting married. which is incredibly profound to me, and it's so true. You know, you really don't know what's going to happen when you start doing this physical work, what's going to release and what's going to come up. So it's a humbling process to do what we do, because you just never know where you're going to go and what's going to come out, and every day is different. So it's an honor to get to do this kind of work with people. So a few other things from what you said that I wanted to pull out just so everybody gets to hear it. We were talking about the fluid, you know, we're 70% water. You know, so to me that says one of the primary things that people can do is hydrate.
Absolutely.
Drink plenty of water. How many people do you think come in your practice who are dehydrated?
A lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do treat women, and that's one of my special areas in the women's health, and take something like incontinence or, you know, urge incontinence, increased frequency of urination, there are a lot of dehydrated people walking mm-hmm. around because they don't want to go to the bathroom every, you know, four times an hour. So they're linking that to their hydration levels, not that there's something really going on with the bladder itself. So there's a lot of dehydrated people walking around. And I think it's like pouring water on a stone at some point. When you look at these, like the fascial adhesions, mm-hmm. that tissue has to be available to absorb that fluid. And when you have a lot of the adhesions all throughout your body like that, that is, you know, a pretty good analogy. You're just pouring water on a stone, and the body isn't able to even absorb it. So
with what moisture is there, the body's going to conserve for the vital organs, and then, you know, the muscles, the joints, skin is all going to, is that an overly simple way of looking at it?
No, I would think so. I mean, your vital organs, your body's going to do what it has to do first for survival. So, you know, the vital organs will take what it needs, and hopefully it has what it needs. A lot of times, I don't think so, you know. I think brains are dehydrated. I think there's, you know,
yeah. I think there's a lot of dehydrated brains.
The body,
yep.
The body's dehydrated. And, you know, we talked about movement, and walking is the absolute most functional thing we do. And when people lose their ability to walk, they lose their independence in life. So to maintain your ability to walk, we have a handout at the clinic, and it's called 30 Minutes for Life. It's one of my favorite handouts, and the statistics are staggering on how you can decrease sometimes by 25% or 30%, and that's huge. The risk of stroke, the risk of heart attack, the diabetes, just by walking 30 minutes a day. And it doesn't even have to be 30 straight minutes.
Mm-hmm. You can do it in 10 minutes.
Like three 10-minute sessions, two 15-minute mm-hmm. sessions, and at the very bottom of the handout, it says 2/3 of men and 3/4 of women, or vice versa, cannot achieve that mm-hmm. daily. It's just,
what does that say about
societal
us?
Norm. That's right.
Yeah.
So just 30 minutes, you know, we don't do it. It's lifestyle.
And we're designed to move. Kim and I have both been reading this book called Born to Run, and it talks about how we're designed not only to walk, but actually to run. Like our and I don't think of myself as a runner. You know, I struggled with running all through high school with injuries and all sorts of stuff. And I know a lot of people think, oh, well, I can't run, you know, but our, if you really take a look, you know, at our physical bodies, we are designed to move. And when
Absolutely.
We don't move, that's when we see problems show up. So
yes.
that exercise piece is so key in staying healthy. There's a great video called 23 and a half hours, which I think we'll probably post as part of the resources. We want to get resources from you at the end of this that we'll post on our Facebook page. And it's basically saying, you know, you're doing all this other stuff for 23 and a half hours of the day. Could you just, for a half hour a day, can you move your body? And it's so simple, but it can make such a huge difference.
And really, it's just the commitment to the time.
Yep.
And, you know, I learned that from you guys, too, with your meditation classes that you teach. And, you know, 30 minutes a day for that, for, you know, in the beginning, it's like, how do I find 30 minutes in my busy schedule to do that? And how do you find another 30 minutes for exercise? But I think it's imperative that we do find it.
Well, if you don't find it, then you're not going to...
You're going to pay later.
You're going to pay later, exactly. It's going to get expensive later. You're not going to have too much time to not find it.
That's
you can
it
say.
Right there, Sam.
Yeah. But, and the last piece from what you were talking about before the break was just that it is, everything's connected. And so it reminded me about something. I think it was one of Deepak Chopra's early books, and there was a poll, and it came out, 90% of physicians believe in the mind-body connection. And his question was, well, how do the other 10% think we wiggle our toes?
You
know? So, I mean, we are all connected. When you know, you talk about working on a knee and seeing something come out in the neck, or, you know, or working on a toe and something come out in, you know, in the hand or the face, we're constantly seeing that in our practice, that there isn't really any separation. You know, we are a society that focuses on specialization, you know, finer and finer specialization. You know, so if you've got this problem, you go to this doctor, and you go to that problem, you go to this doctor. But as a physical therapist, you actually get to treat the whole body and see all those connections at play.
Yes, and it's very intriguing, and that's one of the things I love about the profession. And I would have laughed, you know, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, if someone would have said, you'll be treating women's headaches by treating their pelvic floor muscles. You know, that would have been lost on me. I don't know, no way, you know, what are you talking about?
Right.
And I've given patients bad information over the years. They've asked me, you know, do you think that this hip pain is somehow related to my shoulder? No, that's something different. That would tell, no, that's something different. And insurance restrictions and all that, you know, you get educated like that. You start thinking like that, like an anatomy book. You know, the shoulder's on one page, the hip's on another page.
Right, car parts, yeah.
That's how we're educated, really, you know. That's our educational system, really, in healthcare. And, you know, that idea that we are connected. I feel like I bias myself. If I walk into a treatment room and already I have this agenda of what I'm going to do, I've shut myself down to listen to the body. It's a much better treatment when I walk in, if I do kind of have an agenda, at least a quadrant of a body I'm going to work on, and I can just let my plan go, my agenda. Those are my best treatments. You know, I may have walk in that room not thinking I'm going to work, you know, inside somebody's mouth or, you know, work around their head if they're an ankle patient. But, you know, those are the most effective treatments when you truly listen to the body and, you know, the agenda is not always the best way to go.
Right. It just seems like there's an atmosphere in the moment where there's information that, you know, that you can't get out of a book or already,
Absolutely.
You know, trying to fit the patient into a model. You know, it's being alive and really responding to what's before us.
Yep.
So let's get into talking about some of the more common women's health problems that you treat, and maybe some of the more challenging ones, you know, things that where women may have been to other doctors, and in some cases, I know incontinence is one, because there are drugs out there that are given to women for incontinence, and my experience is I haven't seen that women are particularly happy taking them, that they don't really feel like it's giving them the, you know, the relief that they want, and then a lot of women turn towards surgery for incontinence, and that has its issues because you're breaking and entering and potentially creating scar tissue. And a lot of times incontinence issues show up after childbirth, you know, and so there's like a whole cascade of things. So maybe we take that issue, because I'm sure you deal with that, unless there's another one that you think would be better to delve
pelvic
into.
Pelvic pain and incontinence, those are, you know, those are two common diagnoses.
And we should probably define what incontinence is for our listeners.
Incontinence is the urinary incontinence or fecal incontinence. Mm-hmm. So urinary incontinence is the inability to control your voiding of urine. Stress incontinence is more where you think about, you know, jumping on a trampoline or laughing, coughing, sneezing. And a lot of women, you know, after they have a baby, their mother or their grandma will say, oh, honey, that's just what happens after you have a baby. So we've accepted as a society that's a natural part of aging. And it's not a natural part of aging. And it's absolutely not. And it's treatable. And, you know, the medications have a lot of side effects. Some people, you know, I think at some point with certain issues, you know, they're happy on their medication and that helps them. But it does nothing for the myofascial restrictions. And what I've found is the big overlap is the pelvic floor muscles. And that's the sling of muscles that pretty much run on the whole bottom part of your pelvis. So for a woman from the vagina to the rectum, it's that sling of muscles. And something like an episiotomy, that's a surgery where there's no informed consent, and they cut through the attachment of those muscles.
Mm-hmm. An episiotomy, so a woman's giving birth, and she's and her doctor cuts through the vaginal tissue
perineal areas, mm-hmm. that the opening between the vaginal mm-hmm. opening and the rectal opening, and that is the attachment of the pelvic floor muscle. So when that is cut through, you just cut through a major attachment of a major, major muscle group, and a lot of women are incontinent after that. So it's scar tissue work, and it's internal work. It's internal myofascial release. They have to be willing to do that, which most are. I think they just want help. They don't really care.
They've been suffering for long enough.
Yeah, and, you know, the more babies they have, they're just like, okay, I don't even care anymore, you know. Like, you know, people get desensitized about, you know, body issues and things like that, but it's very treatable, and a lot of it is pelvic floor, the adhesions in the pelvic floor muscles. And the muscle tissue is already shortened. Muscle works on length tension principles. There's an ideal length for every muscle in your body. So if it's overstretched, it's a weak muscle, so to speak. If it's too shortened, which happens with myofascial restrictions, it's a weak muscle. So that's where the weakness is coming in. Kevin asked earlier, you know, if you just free up the tissue, do you need to strengthen? We tend to strengthen. You know, there is. With incontinence, there's different kinds. There's the stress incontinence. There's the urge incontinence. So there's bladder diaries. It's a comprehensive program. You know, people have to pay attention to what they eat. And basically, you know, teach them exercises. And not just the pelvic floor isolated out, but the core itself. And that's a big buzzword in the healthcare, you know, strengthening the core and, you know, core rehab. But basically, it's the pelvic floor, the diaphragm, the transversus abdominis, which is the low abdominal muscles, and then the little stabilizers in the back, multifidus. And that creates a nice little corset around the spine.
Mm-hmm. I've heard Ann Thomas at Body and Balance. She talks about the natural hammock in the pelvic floor, and then the natural corset, the muscles more in the core. So the muscles that sort of pull in and knit together is sort of the corset part, and then the pelvic floor, like in the bowl, those muscles sort of pull up, think about it as a hammock.
Yes.
So visually that helps me imagine what's going on in there.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the treatment is pelvic floor work. I used to treat externally only, and I look back at some of the, not just the athletic women, but certainly, you know, Colorado Springs, where I moved here from, that's, you know, always rated one of the healthiest cities in America to live. So there's a lot of healthy people, a lot of active people, and I look back on some of the women where I plateaued with them because I didn't do the internal work. You know, I was teaching them Pilates. I was teaching, you know, the best way I knew
Kegels.
To teach them the core. Kegel muscles or the Kegel exercises, 24 a day. You know, research has gotten us down to where we've captured that number that you need 24 a day to keep the muscles strong. But, you know, I plateaued with them because I wasn't doing internal work and I wasn't freeing up the adhesions. So no matter how hard they tried to do their Kegels, and no matter, you know, how disciplined they were with their exercises, the fibers and the tissue just wasn't available for them to get their maximum optimal recruitment and their optimal performance of the muscle.
So what kind of changes have you seen now that you're doing internal work, and you're doing rectal and vaginal internal work if it's warranted, depending on what's going on? And what kind of changes do you see now that you can get inside and actually address the tissue directly?
Definitely better outcomes treating incontinence. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. Some people use electrodes, and they're using machines to contract the tissue. I got away from that approach. I started out with that. That was my early education in women's health, and it doesn't really address the fascial adhesions. And, you know, that's my opinion. There's some therapists that that's the basis of their women's health programs. You know, they're using a lot of machines and electrodes and, you know, neuromuscular stimulators that can stimulate the muscle, you know, biofeedback, all of that. But the tissue has to, it has to be flexible and movable and have that extensibility, I think, for optimal relief. And pelvic pain was another issue. You know, that's a pretty common diagnosis that I treat. And there's a huge emotional component with pelvic pain. It's poorly understood. Patients fall through the cracks, men more so than women. You know, women's health, there's been a big push in this country for women's health in the last 15 years, 20 years. Not for men with pelvic pain, they don't always get to the people that they should get to. Some men are unwilling to have the internal work, which for men, it's rectal. They have no other choice. But men that are willing to do that, you know, it can be treated. And there's comprehensive programs, and there's clinics. I don't know that there's one here in Alaska, but I know in Seattle and some of the, you know, some of the surrounding closer states in the lower 48, there are programs where it is pelvic health. It's not women's health. It's pelvic health. They're treating men and women.
Is there anybody in your office who does men's pelvic work, or is there somebody in Anchorage that you refer to?
Keith Porbaugh, he's one of our therapists. He treats men's pelvic health. I will treat it if they arrive. They haven't arrived to my doorstep. And I've asked, you know, from other practitioners that want to refer to me, will you see them? And I'll absolutely see them, but they don't always arrive. And that's the thing, you know, they've got to show up.
And on that subject, for men that have gone through prostate surgery for prostate cancer, or they've had other forms of treatment that have them experiencing incontinence or pain or erectile dysfunction,
yes,
what can you tell them? What are the options for care?
They can come in and have this form of manual therapy, and they do pretty well with it. That really, it was the cancer survivors, the prostate cancer survivors, and a lot of them do end up with ED or they have incontinence. And, you know, men won't really tolerate that. You know, women will tolerate that. Women will just wear a pad and they'll still run or play basketball or whatever. You know, men don't really tolerate that. So that was the early pioneers with women's health, were treating men. And it's treatable. It is treatable. And it's pelvic floor issues, typically. So you treat the pelvic floor. You just access it rectally. And if they're willing to get over some of this, you know, societal taboo of having that type of a treatment done, the treatment's available. And people don't realize that that is a specialty in physical therapy and more therapists are specializing in that. And, you know, that's why I'm happy to be here tonight, too, to kind of get the word out with that it is a treatment with that physical therapists can provide.
Is it painful?
It can be. It can be for women and for men. Typically, if it is painful, you need it. I mean, you know, if you touch a tissue anywhere on your body, if you were to touch tissue and that tissue's painful, well, your body only has a few ways to let you know something's going on, and pain is one of them. But I think the effects of what's going on is probably way more painful than the treatment itself. And with the myofascial work, it doesn't injure you. You're not injuring tissue, but you are reproducing familiar pain. And when I reproduce familiar pain, I know I'm on a structure that I want to spend a little bit of time on. That's what I want to do. I want to find their pain, reproduce that familiar pain. A lot of times it gets just insanely intense for some people, and then it just starts to let up. And we tend to shy away from our pain instead of just confronting it and saying, okay, I'll just let myself feel this pain. And that's a key. If we don't feel, really, we don't heal. I believe that. You have to be able to feel. So you can't be anesthetized. And, you know, we're very over...
just knock me out and do whatever you have to do, right?
We're a very over-medicated society. Uh-huh. And, I mean, and being anesthetized in that form. You know, oh, I have pain. Here, let me take a pill. Your body only has so many ways to let you know. Right. You and I have talked. We've all talked about pain, and I know that's an interest to you, some of the things with pain and the fact that we don't have a pain center in our brain. And I never really put that connection together, you know, when I was studying anatomy and, you know, neuroanatomy. I never really, you know, there's a vision center, a hearing center. We have our... you know, the movement centers, the cortexes, the motor cortex, and there's not a pain center. So you have receptors in your body, certainly, that, you know, are sending that signal, but the pain takes it, like it hijacks those other centers of your brain. But there's no center in the brain that is just designated your pain center. And it's interesting when you start looking at, you know, chronic pain and why you could have the same injury with two different people. One person might go into chronic pain, somebody else heals from that, and they don't have pain. So it's very individualized. It's very poorly understood. The physiology of pain is becoming more and more understood. And something like fibromyalgia used to be considered, I learned, it was a diagnosis of exclusion. And it was, you know, there was nothing, you couldn't find any imaging or anything that showed up that would, so, okay, you have, you know, 11 of the 16 points or whatever it is are tender to touch. Okay, that patient has fibromyalgia. And it's mostly women. I mean, women way more than men statistically. So it became a stereotype. There's another neurotic woman, kind of like headaches were years ago. There's another neurotic woman with, you know, fibromyalgia or with headaches. And there is true physiology behind it. Now we know that. But what doesn't show up on imaging is myofascial restrictions. So when patients come into me and they say, I have had every test available and they cannot find what's wrong with me and I am in pain. This is not in my head. I am in pain. Those are the easy ones for me. I mean, now I look at that and go, oh, well, it doesn't show up on imaging. We are quite likely looking at myofascial restrictions.
And why, you know, just because somebody's in pain, it's interesting that we need to put a physical label on it, that you're in pain because of this thing that we can see under the scan. This is why you're in pain, and now it's acceptable. I mean, emotional pain is pain. Physical pain
is pain. It's a little ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, pain of the soul when you know that you're not doing what you're, you know, you're working in a job and you're feeling like you're in the dead end and you're not being useful. That's pain. Too. So there's all sorts of pain, and it all deserves to be honored. And I think
absolutely,
if people get
triggers,
hurt, yeah,
you can have emotional triggers that they result in true musculoskeletal pain.
Yeah.
You two are married, you know. Have a conversation that's uncomfortable. You start rubbing, you start grabbing your neck, rubbing your shoulder. Oh, I don't want to be in this conversation.
Do that ever.
You know, grab your upper trap, start digging into that area. You know, you get emotions are very linked to physical pain. And I never really had a full appreciation for that as much as I do now at this point in my career. There is a huge link.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a man named Dr. Michael Greenwood who's a specialist with pain, and we're listening to an interview with him. And one of his, you know, he actually has like a camp or a place where people, chronic pain patients that haven't got relief anywhere else, they go to him in Canada. And he has this whole setup where he just basically sets a context and say, we are going to move towards the pain. And that is the exact opposite, you know, of what every instinct and every, you know, biological instinct and also psychological and cultural instinct is to move away from pain.
Right.
But when you move towards it and allow it being there, something else gets mobilized.
Yes, it does.
And the really, no just walls it off, right? You know, you're almost fighting with the pain. You're saying no, no, no. But the pain may be trying to tell you something. It's your, you know, your body, or, you know, you could say your mind. It's trying to communicate with you and give, it's information.
Something's not quite right with the body.
Pay attention.
And what do we do? I mean,
take an aspirin.
A lot of us, take a pain pill. Get rid
drink
of the
some
pain.
Alcohol. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Self-medicate or, you know, officially medicate with pharmaceuticals, you know, however, but we really are a society. And I can see where that program you're speaking of, Kevin, is totally effective. It's so simply stated, you have to feel to heal. Mm-hmm. You have to feel pain. Instead of running from the pain, you have to really acknowledge the pain and feel the pain. The people that I can take to higher and higher levels and help them heal are people that are willing to feel that pain. And it's that tissue memory. It is like they are right there on the spot. They just got in that car accident. They just experienced the rape or the fracture or whatever it is. I mean, it can be that intense. Their body is remembering that pain and they're feeling it, but it's not injurious. That's the difference.
Yeah. The first time Kevin had a cranial sacral treatment, then he actually re-experienced a car accident right on the table. His mom was doing, it was before we ever became acupuncturists, and his mom was doing a treatment on him, and he thought, I'm just going to take a nap. And it was just mind mind-boggling when he described it. It was like he felt the impact of the car accident, and it was wild.
I was in a biology program at Cornell University, and everything really, I had a worldview that was really in the physical sciences, and my mom was doing cranial sacral therapy and therapeutic touch as a registered nurse in Eastern Maine Medical Center, and she had medical interns actually going rotations, watching her, what she was doing. And when I visited her after this automobile accident, she wanted to give me a treatment. I'm like, oh, sure, mom, whatever you want to do. I'll go on the table, you know. And so I really did. I felt like I was just going to take a nap on her treatment table. And all of a sudden, where she was working got very hot in my lumbar region.
That's another way the body tells you you're in a good area to work on.
And then my body lurched off the table, and not once but twice, which is exactly the motion that I had from this this whiplash accident. An automobile hit me from behind and then backed up to get away and hit me a second time on the way getting away. So I had these two whiplash movements, and that happened exactly on the treatment table.
I'm glad you shared that, because that is, we talked about the structural part and the rebounding, but the third piece of myofascial release is called an unwinding. And it's the body hitting that position in space, and intense healing goes on. When your body reproduces whatever that injury was, and I've watched people, they look like they're endoing over the off the mountain bike, or their neck is snapping back. I've seen that in the treatment room. They experience that whiplash, and that's that tissue memory. And you hit these positions in space where then information becomes accessible to the body that wasn't accessible before that. That's where really the healing facilitator comes in. That, you know, they may have to eliminate gravity off of a certain part of your body.
Interesting.
And you can do multiple person unwindings. And when you've got like four therapists or six therapists that can handle someone your size, Kevin, you know, and they could hold you up, your body can go into all kinds of positions of prior injury. Some of it, like, you knew immediately what that injury was. Some people don't know. And it comes up, and it's just like, whoo, I don't know what that was, you know. But and you don't have to. You don't really have to know. When you do know, and then if there's an emotional component, you go away, you spend a little time with it, you process some of those unprocessed emotions, and it just takes healing to a whole different level.
Absolutely. And in my experience, what had only been relieved by anti-inflammatories and painkillers, literally the next day was a turning point. And
it's almost instantaneous, isn't it? And you probably had a strength return to some degree without going, I need to go strengthen this part of my body. You know, it's amazing. There's almost like a spontaneous just ability of the body to be able to move more fluid and to have that strength. And heat is one of the things that you can look for, heat or redness. And the body gets very hot when we're doing the myofascial work. The patients can feel the heat, and they'll say that, oh, can you feel how hot this is? It's intense heat, whether it's internal or external. They can feel it. I can feel it. You know, if there's an area of their body that's hot, and that's not what they're in there for, and it's not the part of the body that they came to have addressed, eventually we need to get to that part of the body. It may not be in that session, but it's, you know, that's that fascial voice again. You know, the body's telling you exactly where to treat, exactly what you have to do. You just have to pay attention.
So I want to get back to we don't have too much time. We got a couple of minutes before the end of the hour, but there's a few muscles. Yeah, 2 minute warning. there's three things: the psoas, the piriformis, and the IT band. And just if you could say a little bit about how they play into the pelvic floor, because we have a lot of people coming in with hip pain, and those are words that get bantered around. So just say a little bit about that.
First of all, the lumbar spine, the pelvis, and the hip, those are three functionally interdependent areas. So one thing can go wrong with one, it's going to go wrong with the other. The psoas and the piriformis tend to be, they're more what we consider global muscles versus the little local stabilizers that come in and attach directly to a joint and stabilize. But those muscles tend to kick in, and maybe they're holding too tight. They're in a hypertonic state. They won't contract and let go. Those are the two classic ones, psoas and the piriformis. Mm-hmm. They're trying to stabilize your body. They're not attached in the right places to provide that kind of stability. But the psoas is actually called the emotional muscle. And when people have emotional trauma or physical trauma, they curl up in a ball, and it doesn't really matter. I know you've read that
David Berselli's.
Trauma release.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be said for that. People curl up And the psoas is the muscle that does that. So fetal position, whether it's emotional injury or it's physical injury, and that muscle doesn't all of a sudden just release and everything's fine. And I'm to the point now where I really believe, like treating PTSD and things like that, diagnoses like that, you can't get there just with the cognitive therapy. There, because there is that link between the tissue tension and the emotion. And I think it should be treated, and with any back pain, certainly. Psoas is also attaches to all five of your lumbar vertebrae and your disc, so it's pulling the disc forward. So that needs to be treated with any lumbar injury. That muscle needs to be addressed.
Great, Kim. We are running out of time for our show tonight, so that is...
We're going to have you back.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very
Thanks,
welcome.
Kim, for being here with us. And
you're
next
welcome.
Week, it's or 2 weeks, not Dr. Nick Begich.
And that'll be June 11th, Monday night at 7 p.m. Hope you can join us.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, everybody.
KVRF Sutton, Radio Free Palmer. 89.5 on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio.
Thank you for joining us on the Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.